A long time ago, on a comics page far, far away. Greetings and welcome to May the Panel Be With You, the Star Wars comic book show brought to you by the Punch-Up Entertainment Network. I am your humble host, Mike Gargoni, and joining me as always, the Luke Skywalker to my Dak, it's John Campbell.
Oh no, you're Dak? Uh-oh.
We always knew. We always knew.
Dak was literally the figure I had because he came free with the snow speeder toy.
Yeah.
We all had a Dak, right? Because they were like, with Dak included. You have to actually pay for the Luke Skywalker.
Yeah. Of course Luke Skywalker comes separate because he comes with a lightsaber and a helmet that comes off. Dak's helmet didn't come off.
No. Why would it need to? He's dead in 2 seconds. Yes, everyone had a Dak. Because we all had that. Oh, we'll get to talk about snow speeders, which I goddamn love. Gargoni, we continue to go through this story entitled The Empire Strikes Back. I have good feelings about this one.
Yeah, I think our heroes are going to come out on top in this one.
This is the good one, yeah. This is going to be really good for us.
Yes, we are continuing our Empire Strikes Back coverage because we are on issue number 40 of Marvel Comics Group Presents The Star Wars. Actually, that's not true. It's just called Star Wars. The Star Wars is a totally different thing.
Which we'll cover someday, as we've talked about.
Someday.
Yeah.
This original Marvel run of the Star Wars comics, continuing with issue number 40, but issue number 2 of our ongoing coverage of The Empire Strikes Back. And boy, are they striking back today. Almost iconically striking back.
Oh, hell yeah, they're striking back. Including what I think is actually maybe my favorite battle in Star Wars, is the Battle of Hoth.
It's... Battle of Hoth is definitely top 5 for me. I don't know if
that's
anything...
That's why I say maybe. Maybe.
Yeah. Sure. Like, God, Battle of Scarif in Rogue One is just so freaking good.
It really is. And that does have one of the coolest things in anything, which is the two Star Destroyers smashing into each other.
Yeah. Or even just like the U-Wings taking out the AT-ATs on Scarif is really cool.
Yeah. That scene is really good. I mean, that said, it's tough because it is... Of course, the Star Wars, so implied there are many, many battles.
Absolutely.
But Hoth, as a kid, when it was just the trilogy, it was just like, ice planet. Everything about Hoth ruled.
Hoth is awesome. We're going to get into a lot of that today. We are covering issue number 40. It came out in October of 1980, a mere 6 months after the movie released.
But you know what? I'm going to confirm this. I bet it's still number one at the box office.
While you're looking that up, we got a lot of the same creative team as before. Archie Goodwin, star writer. Al Williamson now doing the coverage here on the pencils. We've got Carlos Garzon on inks. We've got Glynis Oliver Nayween on colors and Rick Veitch on letters with a certain Mr. James Shooter as our editor.
Rick Veitch, a guy who's around comics for quite a while. I know that name.
Oh, yeah.
October is actually the first month that it's no longer number one. And boy, this speaks to a different time in movies. Private Benjamin, the Goldie Hawn comedy where she joins the army, is now number one.
That is a movie that totally exists.
Goldie, I mean, yeah, going to, I mean, that was a total gross of $69 million, which was big then.
Sure, yes.
So, spent 11 weeks at the box office there. So, you know, it's an interesting thing. But that was a time when Goldie Hawn was one of the biggest movie stars. But yes, its release in May until October 10th, Star Wars is number one, Empire is number one. So,
curious, after... the box office smash of Private Benjamin. Does Empire Strikes Back come around again?
I think it does, yes. Until... so that's an interesting... I believe it does come back around until December when, once again, our boy Flash Gordon shows up.
Okay.
Sadly, November, though, you get The Awakening, which is an incredibly boring mummy movie, Charlton Heston, that we covered on Meet the Monsters. and you should not watch. But I understand that it was around Halloween time that was big. So,
okay.
Interesting to look at, though. I will say, not a lot of other like huge movies that people would know of in that like 1980 season.
Well, except for the one big one, The Empire Strikes Back.
Right, that's what I mean. It's sort of like, once again, this was a time, to keep putting it in this time capsule, like, it wasn't, 1980 wasn't a time when, like, there was a summer blockbuster every weekend in the summer. It was sort of like, you got one, maybe two, but other than that, it's like, mostly, like, smaller comedy. I mean, you know, it was the summer of sequels, because, lest we forget, in August of that year... we got Smokey and the Bandit 2, which, of course, was the second highest grossing movie in 1977 after Star Wars. So, same turnaround on both of those two.
Did Smokey and the Bandit 2 put up just as big numbers?
It did pretty well, actually. Okay. Total gross of $66 million.
All right.
I mean, Star Wars made $209.
Well, look... widely talked about as the movie that destroyed box office expectations, the Star Wars.
Yeah. that's it exactly. Like, second highest grossing movie that year, though, this is going to, once again, painting the picture of what that year was, 9 to 5. The Dolly
Parton. No, John, the year was 1980.
Oh, right. No, yeah. 9 to 5, though, was the second highest grossing movie of 1980.
That's the Dolly Parton movie?
Yeah. Working 9 to 5. Living. Yeah. That, it's just crazy. Once again, it's just, it shows you, though, just how different a landscape it was. That it was like Star Wars, and then everything else was pretty much just sort of like a middle tier movie. Like, you know, they weren't blockbusters all the time. Anyway, all that leads us back to Star Wars, continuing the official. Remember, don't be fooled by imitators. This is official.
Let's bring up this cover, because there's a lot to talk about here.
Of The Empire Strikes Back.
You talk about possible bootlegs, and these olive green AT-ATs speak to me of something that like is you get these in your toy box marked Galaxy Battle.
Yeah, exactly. They're the BTBTs. Yes. I mean, certainly when we were talking about how The Empire Strikes Back is so iconic in pop culture, and it has so many of the things people think of when they think of Star Wars, and the AT-ATs are one of those, right?
Yeah. I mean, what one of the big things for Empire Strikes Back specifically was this huge broadening of, let's call them what they are, toyetic merchandising capabilities of the vehicles in these movies. I mean, the Battle of Hoth alone has like three different like modes of transportation that are not used in the rest of the film.
Right.
And that being like the Snowspeeder, the AT-ATs, and the Tauntauns.
Right. Yeah. And so that's wild. Like, those are all things that are, once again, iconic Star Wars stuff. And I think that was a big reason why Star Wars sort of changed the landscape, too, when we talked about sort of the idea of sequels going bigger, which was not... The other thing is also just different. It wasn't like, give them more what they want. It's like, no, we're new planets, new ships, new... even designs of our characters. Certainly, that's very much a thing that Marvel to this day is like, nope, every movie, our superheroes need to get a slightly different costume.
So that can get a little frustrating at times.
But that's I feel like that started from Star Wars, where it's like, well, no, you got to get the Empire Strikes Back Han Solo figure, you know?
Yeah, and look, we talk about toys, because right at the top of this cover here, we have a big banner. We talked last issue about, like, what's this prize you could be winning? We drilled down a little bit on this in this issue, because that big prize that this comic book could be worth, turns out it's a Toys R Us shopping spree.
God, do you remember this as a kid? The Toys R Us shopping spree?
Yeah.
It was on Nickelodeon, was big when we were kids. And God, I remember just going, like, if only. God, I wanted that so bad.
And there was like, I don't know how you acquired this, but they would always film it and show it on Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
The kid with the shopping cart rushing through Toys R Us.
Yeah.
Just, okay, we got to hit the action figure aisle. Then we're hitting the Legos, then the Nerf guns, then the basketballs.
Yeah.
Just throwing them into a cart, seeing what you can get.
Isn't that crazy? I mean, and it was just like, oh, you couldn't, it blew your mind. Because I remember like, it was maybe like, once a year, my grandparents would send like money for my birthday, and I could spend that at Toys R Us. But we weren't going to Toys R Us on the regular. It was like a special thing, and it was magic to me as a kid, where it was just like, oh, and I can buy, you know. And once again, I walked in there with like $50 from my grandparents, and I was the richest man in the world at like 8 years old with $50 in my pocket. I was just like, oh my God. The damage I can do in here.
And I think it speaks to a lot of things. It speaks to obviously the like innocence of youth in terms of just the overwhelming nature of a store that's only toys. What?
Yeah. I know.
It's like, okay, you could do an aisle or two of that at a Fred Meyer or a Sears, but the whole store?
It was like, wait a minute, what are you talking about?
Fred Meyer, for those listeners who don't know, that's our local Kroger brand.
Yeah, that's
brand
the Kroger.
These days.
Yeah.
It wasn't always Kroger here, but it is now wrapped into that.
Right, yeah. It's all under, everything is owned by one company. So anyway, that is like, but it, yes, as you speak to this, this is definitely, are you bringing up the point, this is definitely speaking to, they are selling this to children.
They are selling this to children. They know what the marketing push on this movie is going to be and who's going to be the, let's just call what it is, the battleground with which those toy wars will be fought. And that is on the aisles of Toys R Us.
Well, and that's it, exactly. And that's the key to so much of the first movie was that they gave Lucas all the toy money, all the merchandising money, which means that every movie after the first movie was financed entirely out of George Lucas's pocket up through the prequels until he sold to Disney, of course. But that's one of the craziest things about Star Wars is Empire Strikes Back through Revenge of the Sith are all independently produced movies. They're distributed by 20th Century Fox, but they were entirely made by George Lucas. So that's a crazy thing to think about, right? He made so much money off of the merch of the first movie that he never had to find financing for a Star Wars movie again. And they just continued to make money.
Yeah, and that's
all the merchandise
part of where some of the troubles with the prequels come up, right? Is like, because he has carte blanche say on something and no one says no to him, we get things like Jar Jar Binks.
Well, that's one of the weird things that you'll see across Empire Strikes Back into Jedi, right? Like, Empire Strikes Back is actually the one Lucas was least involved in. Sort of outlined it, but Kasdan did the final script. He hired Irvin Kershner to direct it. And then, kind of what I gather, he sort of didn't like that people thought it was bad. Like, I mean, there was sort of a thing. So when you get Richard Marquand on Return of the Jedi, much more of a guy who George Lucas could not control, but definitely be like, maybe consider this, Richard.
There's a lot of discussion in, like, oral histories of the Return of the Jedi
and
about
much
him kind
push
of
push back on things Kasdan wanted to do. Kasdan was not as thrilled with the way that turned out because he was like, George was kind of much more like, we're not going to do that. And I think also by the time you get Return of the Jedi, it's a brand now. So you get much more into conversations about that's not Star Wars. Like there's, it's still Empire. It's still a little open into like, what even is this franchise?
But it does solidify a lot of those things in terms of like, it's the different kinds of spaceships, it's big space battles, it's creatures, it's puppets, it's all
the big thing
stuff.
Is, and it's interesting that we bring this up because the idea of this being aimed at kids, it also opens up to, it can be more mature, it can be darker, you know, I mean, like it shows that there were different tones within it. And so, yes, we have Luke on Battleground Hoth in his crashed snowspeeder with his lightsaber squaring off with some AT-ATs. And some, I will say, not amazingly rendered smoke coming out of this thing.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what's happening there. But obviously, tough to, like, really render smoke against the white background of snow.
I get that, yeah. But it's coming off a little like Pig Pen from Peanuts.
well, who knows? Maybe Dax's corpse is really smelly.
I don't understand. On an ice planet, that body started rotting instantly somehow.
Yeah, it's really warm inside those cockpits.
Yeah. Anyway, let's... Yeah, we had the heat cranked up. It's so cold. So let's open up the comic here and talk about our creative team, which is... Oh, we already did, didn't we? Never mind.
Because yeah. We talked about... the only big difference we see here is Dan Fingeroth as the assistant editor. So yes. You got a lot of... You got all hands on deck for this book.
Well, this has got Fingeroth written all over it, man. That's for sure. but yeah, we once again have our splash page and a like much more modern previously on Star Wars.
Yeah, pretty tamped down. It almost seems like a rewrite of the opening crawl a little bit.
But yeah, it's interesting. And this is Han Solo, right?
Yep, aiming his blaster. We've got a really just stark white snow speeders here. I found that very interesting that they don't really have much detail there.
Yeah, but I also like seeing them at night because we only really ever see them fly during the day. It's kind of cool to see them against a star background. All right, it's Battleground Hoth. When we open this up, everybody's running to their stations. It's all hands on deck. The Empire is attacking.
You can just hear the alarms in the background. The
yeah. Woo, you know, John. Woo. Yeah. You know John Ratzenberger's in there somewhere.
that's true.
I love that he's in both Superman and Empire Strikes Back. It's just so random.
he's showing up for stuff.
And then once again, though, we immediately could see C-3PO going, listen to those ice creatures howl.
So, yes, for those who were with us last time, we have this developing plot of there are Wumpas loose on Echo Base.
It's a hat on a hat, man, is what the problem is here.
The Empire's coming, but also there are these ice monsters crawling around in your ducts.
And this cut to 3PO is almost just like, and don't forget the ice creatures.
Will this go anywhere? No. Yeah. But it is a dangling plot thread that is in the original shooting script that they're clearly working off of.
Well, let's talk about some real horror beat here when we go to the next page. And Luke is cosplaying as the Phantom of the Opera.
Yeah, what's this weird like mask that they're pulling off of his face?
I don't know, but if you watched Echo, is it similar to that eye patch that was rebuilding Wilson Fisk's eye where it's like doing something? I don't know.
Yeah,
it's weird. Yeah, this is a weird moment where it's a little creepy.
Okay. Obviously, this is probably what was in the script and the original thoughts behind Mark Hamill between Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back got into a really bad car accident that like mangled his face.
Yes.
And
needed
kind
like
of famously
surgeries and stuff to reconstruct it. And so that's why Mark Hamill looks different in Empire.
They address that to a certain extent by having him get attacked by the Wumpa and that whole like I was in the back to tank sequence. Like that was kind of them addressing why Mark Hamill would look different in this film.
Right, because they make a point of showing him get the claw to the face at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah. And I gotta figure maybe this was like yet another, like, okay, we're really driving home the point that he's had some reconstructive surgery in the film.
Yes.
And I think it was probably smart to remove that from the final
product. Yeah, we were, because, once again, if you're just following as an audience member, it's like hit in the face, found in the snow, in the medical center, he's got scars. It's one thing where it's just like, how much detail do you need to put in this?
And do you really need to, like, linger on that fact when you can just move on and, like, people get it? He's Luke Skywalker. Mark Hamill got into an accident.
As a kid, before I knew that, I never really questioned any of this. Like, why does he look different? It's like, oh, you get hit by that Wampa.
And it's so interesting that they went out of their way to even address it because, back in the 80s, it's not like you had the internet where you could constantly be tracking what people looked like. Like, unless fucking somebody shaved their mustache off or, really had, like, wild disfigurement happen to their face. It's not like you even had the capability of watching A New Hope and Empire, like, side by side, really.
No, not really. And the other thing is, even if you did notice the scarring on his face, one would assume that there were years in between where there were battles where maybe Luke Skywalker had scars. I mean, they do that with Anakin purposefully, yeah. Not just out of, you know, unexplained nature in Revenge of the Sith. Like, he's been through war. And yeah, and this is just creepy. It's
just creepy. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I mean, you mentioned Phantom of the Opera, and that's definitely...
Bum, 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 bum. Bum, bum.
I keep expecting him to have a grudge against a theater owner.
Leia, don't you know? They kept me from writing my opera. and then, boy, do things
I was get... a prisoner of the Turks, was it? I forget.
Well, I mean, like with a lot of stuff, if you listen to Meet the Monsters, there's any number of different origins for that guy, depending on. But you're talking about the original novel?
Yeah.
Yeah, Gaston Leroux. I believe you're correct on that. Okay. And also, he was just like born looking weird in the book. A lot of the movies add an origin for what happened to his face. All right. Mm. But then things get real sexy between these siblings. More so than is in the movie. There's the one kiss that's in the movie, which is weird, but is still is like slightly mellowed only because it's the one that's in this later when it's about making Han jealous.
That's the thing. In the movie, it feels way more about Leia trying to get underneath Han's skin. Whereas here, at the bottom of this page, we have Leia talking to Luke, saying, like, I was afraid for you. I worry you're okay. And Luke saying, Leia, I don't really know how to say this, but you must know that you, well, you're the only one that I, and then they are about to kiss. And
you were looking at a draft of this. Is this in that draft you were looking at?
Ooh, what a good question.
Because this is played in the movie, it's played as they're just talking and then she kisses him, which we'll see later for Han's benefit. But here they add this thing about these two have such tension that Han interrupts.
Yeah.
Because to me, Empire, even before they made the sibling reveal in Jedi, Empire was really about breaking up that love triangle and making it pretty clear that the romance was Han and Leia, even before you knew they were siblings.
Yeah. You
know, I mean, like there really isn't any hot tension between them and Empire, even though she kisses him weirdly.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm scrubbing through this draft now trying to find whether or not there is hot sexual tension between brother and sister.
Because as we've talked about from similarly looking at different drafts, Lucas's initial idea was that Luke had a sister out there, but was a separate character from Leia. And then by the time they got to Jedi, they just sort of condensed stuff down and made that easier.
Oh boy, it's so much worse in the script.
Yeah, and once again, that's not like, ew, because it's like whatever Kasdan was writing was based on information that she wasn't his sister. And he was obviously writing to, as most people would coming off the first movie, some kind of love triangle. All right, what's in the script?
Okay, I will bring this up for our viewers on YouTube so they know that I'm not lying here.
I would love, what a great improv game if you were just making that up. Your skills would be okay, amazing.
Okay, so scene 57, interior medical center, rebel base. Luke is out of his chamber, lying in bed, yada, yada, yada. Leia saying the back toe's growing well, scars should be gone in a day or so. Luke saying it's fine, but then he says, Leia, when I was out there and it looked pretty bad, well, it made me think about things. Leia, me too. I was afraid. Comic has this word for word, basically. Script. Their eyes meet. Luke touches her cheek with his hand. Luke, I don't really know how to say this. I never have before. Leia, you know how I feel about you, ellipses. And in caption blocking, it says, she does. And it's confusing. Their lips are very close, about to kiss. The doors open noisily, and 3PO enters the room with R2. Leia pulls back, startled.
This had to be the case, because I can't imagine the comic just making this up. You know what I mean? Like, adding this.
Yeah. And in the comic, it's the captioning says, in this, like, steamy panel on the bottom left, uncertain, but drawn by the moment, the princess leans close to the young rebel hero. Yeah, they're about to do an incest.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like I said, yeah, actually, in some ways, the movie, people always go, oh, she kissed her brother, and you're like, Yes, and they didn't know that. However, it actually still plays kind of not at, let's say, not as horrible as it could have been, as we now definitively know, because we've seen the alternative, which is this.
Could have been this. Yep.
Could have been this. Could have been a lot fucking worse, you guys. So maybe calm down.
But yeah, in the comic, the moment passes. And sure Luke does. Says, hey, what do you think I could go to Dagobah?
Hi.
Hey, Leia.
Yeah. And then immediately she's like, wait a minute. What the? What?
First Han, now you.
Yeah. Because, yeah, he's just like, maybe. Leia, would it be cool if I ran off to Dagobah just like real quick? Am I really needed around here?
Leia's like, what the fuck is a Dagobah?
Yeah. And then in walks, I don't know whose face this is, but it's not Harrison Ford's.
Yeah. There's a bad case of smooth face going on here.
There really is. And the thing about that is, we haven't been too harsh about the likenesses, except for Williamson does draw closer to likenesses. So when he's off, it stands out more.
Yeah, and I like, look, we got a pretty good Mark Hamill here in the top right panel. Yeah, and I think his Leia is good in every panel.
Really good. He's really nailing, which I said is so interesting because it's the exact opposite of that's really the character who gets really let down by Infantino's harsh, harsh faces.
Whereas in like the top left panel here with Han, he's just Steve Blankface. And then in the bottom left panel, he's Val Kilmer.
Yeah. Yeah, he is. That last panel, he's smoldering with an intensity never seen from Harrison Ford.
And in the bottom right panel, Luke suddenly looks like Dr. Evazan.
God damn it. Absolutely.
I'm wanted in 12 systems.
I know he's scarred, but is he that scarred? Jesus Christ. Yeah, so anyway, they're all talking around, and isn't the Empire actively attacking at this point?
Not at this point. They know the Empire's on the way, though.
Okay.
And Leia's like, look, the two of you can't just leave. We are so fucked right now.
Yeah. Like, they're approaching our doorstep, and they're just like, but we've got other stuff to do.
Yeah, thankfully, it looks like Admiral Riken has stopped Han from taking off, and he's going to be here for the long haul, which has got to make Leia happy, right?
Hey, what's Leia think about this? And it's just like, oh, God. Yeah. Leia does, when we turn the page here, Leia does kiss Luke, but it's the exact thing from the movie where it's more about Han's reaction.
Yeah, because like the comic goes out of the way to say like she stares at Han and then goes in for the smooch.
Which makes the romantic kiss, as hard as this is, folks, ignoring the fact that we know that they will be siblings, it also makes it even weirder because you're like, what do you want, lady? Because like you were just getting real hot and heavy with this guy. Now you're kissing him to be more flirting with the other guy. And my guess is that's why they changed it. Not that they knew they were going to be siblings, but more it's just like, we've kind of got to pick a lane. Otherwise, Leia becomes a little maybe unlikable to the audience.
Oh, yeah, totally. If she's active, able to, like
yeah, immediately
turn it on and off depending on who's in the room.
Yeah, it's like, what do you want? You can't have it both ways. And then, it comes off like, are you just toying with both of these guys? That's not cool.
Well, and look, obviously they're not open to the throuple situation a la Wolverine, Jean Grey, and Cyclops.
Yeah, we just solved that with an that ability.
It's like, but what if they were just all like living in the same house together?
It does feel like after decades of that triangle, yeah, that makes sense.
Especially during the Krakoa era when everything was just like, everyone's free game, whatever.
Yeah, man. Like, we're just not putting labels on anything anymore.
Yeah, it's fine.
All right. So Vader and the Imperial fleet have arrived in the Hoth system.
Yeah. Lord Vader, we have moved the fleet out of light speed, but comm scan has detected energy field protecting the area of the sixth planet. The field is strong enough to deflect any bombardment.
So let me also mention this, because I've never thought about this. It's the ice planet Hoth in the Hoth system.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So both the planet and the system are named Hoth.
Oh, boy. Okay. Here we go.
Oh, crap. Okay.
A lot of times in Star Wars.
Now I stepped in it.
Yes, you did.
Yeah.
A lot of times in Star Wars, it happens a lot. And mostly what this is nerds like me trying to make sense of this after the fact.
Of course. I mean, that isn't that most like major franchises is like inconsistencies in scripts having to make sense for people?
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of times in Star Wars, they will refer to a system and a planet as the same thing. So the implication being that, like, okay, the actual name of the planet that we see in Empire Strikes Back, the Ice World, would technically be Hoth 6, because it is the sixth planet of the Hoth system.
Followed, yeah.
In the same way that, like, Endor, that everyone refers to as Endor, is actually the forest moon of Endor, Endor being the gas giant that we see.
Now, see, that I knew, because they do talk about it being the moon of Endor.
Right. And Yavin 4, of course, being the fourth planet of the Yavin system.
Yeah, right. And that makes sense because they actually call that Yavin 4. But Hoth, that's where they kind of play. It's Hoth, both the system and the planet, and they use them interchangeably.
And usually when that happens, it's sort of implied in Star Wars specifically that, like, when you have just the name of a system and no other names of the planets, there's so little going on in that system that they never bothered giving the planets names.
I see. Yes.
It's just like, okay, Hoth is this out of the way. We know it's got this one ice ball of a planet that's technically habitable, and that's it. So we're just going to call the whole thing Hoth and keep on moving our interstellar cartography vessel away from here.
Yeah. I do love Vader saying the rebel scum are alerted to our presence. Ozzel came out of lightspeed too close to the system. And then this is Veers he's talking to, right?
He is talking to Veers here. Yeah. What's interesting is in the movie, these two conversations happen over like telecommunications,
which is over a video screen. It leads to the less cool thing here where he just chokes the guy in the room, or when he chokes him over the thing, it's like, oh fuck, he's really powerful. But I love this Vader line of, he is as clumsy as he is stupid.
Vader always loves getting his digs in.
I know. I love when Vader just trashes somebody like that, you know? Well, that guy
don't
sucks.
Choke on your aspirations.
Yeah. That kind of stuff. I like a snarky Vader.
Vader's always been low-key snarky, and we love him for that.
Yeah, what just makes him a little bit like, ooh, some part of him is kind of enjoying his evil, you know?
Oh, ooh. Absolutely. Yeah. That's a little bit of the Anakin coming out.
Yeah. Well, because that is true, because Anakin is written to have a bit of a smartass quality to him, particularly in Clone Wars. He chokes this guy, which once again is not as cool because he doesn't choke him over video feed, which rules.
Well, and we get the classic turnaround of like Captain Piet to Admiral Piet when the guy whose job he's taking is dead next to him.
Doesn't he say something about that he's actually promoted in the movie? Doesn't he say like congratulations on your promotion in the movie?
Something like that.
Yeah, it's a little bit, once again, it's a little bit snarkier in the movie. It's a little bit more clever in the movie than just you're in command now, Admiral Piet. There is something about, like, congratulations, you've been promoted. And the guy's like, gee, thanks.
Gulp.
Okay. Another Francavilla, we talked about this on the last issue, but another Francavilla-esque drawing of Leia there when we're at the bottom of the page.
The harsh blacks and oranges and reds making this moody image.
It's very cool. Now we are getting ready. As they talk about, the alert is now in its final stage. There are stages of alerts.
You go DEFCON? From green alert to blue alert to red alert. That's how it goes.
There's only two in Star Trek. There's just yellow and red.
The less seen purple alert is for diplomatic emergencies.
Oh, actually, Star Trek Discovery does introduce the concept of black alert, but I don't like Star Trek Discovery. So, although I remember thinking black alert sounded cool. Leia's given orders to everybody, and that continues into the next page. She's setting up for the battle. By the way, that's a clearly rendered Wedge back there, isn't it?
Yeah, look, Wedge is around. Again, Wedge, the longest serving, best capable rebel pilot that exists.
We are huge Wedge supporters on this show because that guy does almost everything Luke Skywalker does on the battlefield and doesn't get anywhere near the credit.
I would argue Wedge actually has one up on Luke Skywalker because he's the
final Death Star run.
He's got two Death Star X marks on the side of his cockpit.
That's right. God damn, Wedge is awesome. And we'll get to the Rogue Squadron book, which I know is a big reason why both of us love him as well. Yes. But God damn, Wedge is so cool. He's one of the most underappreciated badasses of Star Wars. And you do, especially by the time you get a third movie, when you're actually paying attention, you're like, Jesus, he was there for all of this. That is why I'm glad, though, he is in the celebration on Endor at the end of that movie. And you're like, God damn right he should be. And in fact, later there's a line in this issue where they talk about him being like the lone survivor. And I'm like, he's always the lone survivor. That's his thing, man. But anyway, we haven't really seen him rendered. He's always just kind of around or often drawn as just one of the X-Wing pilots in this. This is the first time where I'm like, that is a likeness of actor Dennis Lawson.
Yeah.
Dennis with one N, by the way. Here's the thing I just learned from looking at the IMDb for Empire Strikes Back. Incorrectly spelled in the original theatrical release as two N's in the credits of that movie. Yeah. And of course, the other Star Wars thing we should mention, uncle of Ewan McGregor.
That's true. Yeah, Star Wars runs thick in their blood.
It sure does.
We have, of course, also Tony Stark as one of the pilots in the back right corner of that panel.
It absolutely is Tony Stark. And it's like, you get to your snow speeders. You get to that. You put on your Iron Man armor.
Could Iron Man single-handedly take out a Star Destroyer?
Ooh, that's a good question.
TIE fighters, of course, no problem.
Yeah, that's a given. You talk about a Star
AT-ATs, probably, I think.
Yeah, I think he could repulsor blast the legs, right? Like, or
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
or,
yeah. Or like pry his way into the cockpit or something.
Yeah, that's the thing. He could probably get on it because he'd be faster. They wouldn't be able to target him. Star Destroyer would be tougher. Once again, he could get aboard. I think that would be key. And then, of course, you know he could muck up the engines and stuff. I think he could. I don't think he'd actually like take it down, but I think he could infiltrate and certainly he's going to take out a bunch of stormtroopers. No one's going to get in his way. So I think I think it's a matter of could he get onto it. Yes, I do think so.
And he just needs to have the good luck not to board the one with Darth Vader.
Right. Yes. That's where it would be tougher for him.
Yeah, because I feel like Darth Vader pretty handily fucks up.
Well,
Iron Man.
Magic, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's the magic thing. It really is sort of like, you know, I mean, that's where like, yeah, I mean, like he's got a shot. Well, there's a good question, actually, and now I'm just fully derailing us. But like one of Superman's vulnerabilities is magic. Would that include the Force?
I would say yes.
I mean,
but
in the parlance of Star Wars, the Force is definitively magic. But in the world of DC, where you have actual like proper sorcerers and sorceresses, would that... Would the Force be considered?
I think that constitutes as magic because you're dealing with like an otherworldly energy field that only certain people can tap into properly.
So then
and
that
is basically what DC magic is.
Yes, yeah, so Superman would be vulnerable to the Force then by that argument.
Yeah, I would say. Okay, right. You could Force choke Superman.
I think that's, although of course, you know, that's always been one of the vagaries of Superman weakness because it does get into like, what do you mean by magic, right? Like, okay. Yeah. Anyway.
Now, okay, you have to be strong enough in the Force to be able to like crush his super larynx, and that is
a
level of Force strength. Though.
There you go. That's key. I think he'd be more vulnerable to things like Force lightning, where it's an actual magical force like hitting him, as opposed to the strength just being amplified.
I think you could like Force grab him and like lift him up, and he couldn't necessarily do anything about it.
There's a lot of questions.
Because again, weakness is magic. Sure, why not?
Yeah, I think that would be a pretty interestingly balanced battle of like very well trained Force user. Anyway, guys, draw that for us, please. I'm always just asking people to draw stuff on these podcasts because
I want the throne room sequence from Return of the Jedi, except instead of Luke Skywalker, it's Superman.
Bring it. I would love it. Yeah, because like, where does heat vision versus Force lightning break down? Anyway.
Who's to say?
Yeah. All right. Back to this comic, though. So everybody's getting ready to go into battle.
Leia's laying out the plan. They're going to launch some escape craft, and they're going to lower the shield just enough so that the ion cannon can fire and hit the Star Destroyers. This is such a cool, like, war element of this movie that I've always dug.
I love anytime you get to military leader Leia, and she's like, you, we're going to here. We're going to do this. Like, you're like, right, that's what she's awesome at. Of course, she can fight one-to-one, but, like, what she's bringing to the war is she's the military leader. She's the general. Also, kind of Williamson's likenesses are really good, as we've talked about for the most part. But this Han pose of him leaning is perfect. He's got the physicality of the character that I feel like has been missing in Infantino's. That just sort of like very cowboy. I mean, he is sort of that old Western hero, kind of like laconic, like, yeah, I'm just here moseying about. And then part of the Falcon explodes because it always does.
Yeah. Look, they're trying to repair the Falcon. It's not going well.
Yeah. Which is a great turn where he's like, yeah, it should do it too. Oh, shit.
Can I say we're also coming up on, and I'm glad it's in this comic, the line that is like probably the most like offhandedly quoted by me Star Wars line that exists.
Okay. Yeah. Which is?
Like, this is one of those, like, do you ever have one of those, like, phrases that you just, like, kind of say to yourself in whatever, like, movie quote or whatever you're, just on a day-to-day basis, the good, our first catch of the day, is something I just say to myself when something happens in my life all the fucking time. And in that, like, it's our first catch of the day. Like, emphasizing the catch is the line delivery.
And it's a thing where it's like, that's not like an iconic line from this, but things. But for whatever reason, it has hit you. And I get that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the Monty Python, like, oh, 'tis but a scratch if you get hurt.
Yes.
But like, whenever, like, I don't know, like, my first call comes in at work or like I'm having my delivery of my food arrives at home. Like, ah, good. My first catch of the day.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's to each their own. 'Cause that's not a line that's ever stuck out to me, but
no,
but for whatever reason there you go. There's a little,
it's also like it imprinted on me, I think, at a young age, because I think it like really emphasizes the banal evil of the Empire in a way that a line delivery from the Emperor or Vader doesn't necessarily. Because that's just some captain who says that.
These guys are just at work, and their work happens to be they're going to, like, slaughter a bunch of people. Yeah.
Yeah.
which is definitely like, oh, God.
Next page, we got some more Francavilla art.
I actually really like this lighting for the command center. I kind of wish it was in the movie. I'm not sure it would fit with the visuals, but I love it.
There is a lot of like dark underlit scenes in the film of them in the command center, but it's not like obviously this dramatic.
Because I'm going to say it, Kirshner's a better director than Lucas, and he does a lot of, like, Empire's a better looking movie than Star Wars. There's so many more interesting lighting setups. You get a lot more locations, number one, but just in general, there's a lot more evocative sort of filmmaking in Empire.
Who was the DP on Empire?
That's a good question. Because that's also part of it too, right?
Obviously, we want to give credit to the director as well, but director of photography on any given movie, especially in ones with like very iconic framing, is a lot of director of photography work there.
There's also a lot more source lighting in it, like the way the sets themselves are lit and where the lights in the scenes are a big part of it. Peter Schutze, or Schutze. Shukitsi? I don't know how to pronounce his name exactly. let's see, what else did he... Oh, he also shot the Rocky Horror Picture Show in 1975.
Oh, okay.
And then the movie he makes after Empire Strikes Back is Krull.
Krull? Oh, yeah. I've got a soft spot in my heart for Krull.
I also love Krull. And then he, starting in 1988 with Dead Ringers, he becomes Cronenberg's go-to guy.
Oh, cool.
Which is makes sense for sort of dark, evocative science fiction. This is the only Star Wars movie he shot, though, is Empire. And none of the other ones look like Empire.
Uh-uh. Yeah. I got a feeling that somebody who's a little bit more moldable was also found for DP in Return of the Jedi.
Yeah, because, I mean, a lot of the Star Wars movies, particularly the ones Lucas directed, are, and this is, you know, not necessarily a bad thing, but he shoots very flat, right? Like, it's very, the colors are bright. Everything is pretty brightly lit. Empire's where a lot of the darkness comes through. And when you, I mean, but I'm talking about just even in the design, I mean, so much of it's on Imperial ships, which are darker, more militaristic. There's a lot of metallic sort of lighting, you know, sets.
We're in caves, we're in swamps, we're in caves and evil swamps. Places.
Yeah, and then when you, even when you get to Cloud City, you have the city, but then a lot of it is in the underneath, in the carbonite chamber and stuff like that, right? Things get more industrial.
Well, and part of the, like, striking visuals of Cloud City is the bright, sunny facade is what hides the darkness beneath.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And so that, you know, it's just, it's a beautiful looking movie.
Yeah, it turns out Empire Strikes Back is really good.
I mean, there's a lot of reasons why I think it's the best one. So anyway, the battle begins. We're firing the ion cannons.
Love the ion cannon. Love the ion cannons. Kind of EMP blast that takes out the Star Destroyers so the transports can get away. Strange note here, we don't actually ever see the transports.
No.
I found that interesting.
I do too. Also, when the ion blast hits the Star Destroyer, it does way more visual damage than it does in the movie here.
Yeah, in the movie it just kind of like hits with the blue and crackles and the ship
here there's like an explosion of fire and the whole thing is tilting.
Well, it tilts in the movie too.
It does, but it's really jarring here.
Yeah, it establishes the weird law in Star Wars that a ship that is sinking in space will actually drift downward to frame for some reason.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because he had them watch old World War II movies as reference as well.
Yeah, because it looks cool is the answer.
And so, here's Luke and Han saying goodbye. And he's like, gee, I hope everything works out with you and Jabba. And Han once again says, hell.
Give him hell, kid.
And then everybody's running to their fighters, and we meet everyone's favorite new side character, Dak.
Glad to see you back and well, sir. Now I feel like we can take on the whole Empire. Gee whiz.
Yeah, and the second, even if you've never seen that movie, the second he says that movie, you're like, this guy's fucking dead. When, as soon as he goes, we could take on the whole Empire, you're like, you're not going to make it out of this, pal.
The moment anyone calls Luke Skywalker sir, who isn't C-3PO,
you're done. That's the equivalent of wearing a red shirt in Star Wars. You're fucking dead. Oh boy, he's done. He's done, you guys. Pack it in.
Yeah. So long, fair Dak. We hardly knew thee.
Yeah. Anyway, everybody's taken off here. 3PO and R2 are just standing around.
Well, R2's getting loaded up into Luke's X-Wing, and he's getting told by 3PO, hey, take care of yourself.
Yeah. Hey, you be careful out there. I've got nothing to offer.
I'm going to go be a physical hindrance to those boarding the Millennium Falcon.
If anything, I'm about to cause some trouble, folks. It does seem like it takes way too long for them to power. It feels like anytime any battle starts to break out, you should just immediately turn off 3PO.
It would certainly probably help.
You know what? Just pack him up as storage at this point.
Look, he's a protocol droid. Yeah. He's not a war droid. We know this.
Somebody box that droid up. All right.
But so, then on the next page, what's this coming? Classic scene in all of Star Wars is them like focusing on the horizon. Then you get the like the push in zoom and what's this?
Out on the horizon, it looks like. And then
fucking monsters made of metal clomping across the horizon.
Very cool.
I love the addition here of the lone Tauntaun rider fleeing the AT-AT.
Oh, God. Are we to think that this is the first time they've seen AT-ATs in battle against them? I mean, it is for us as an audience, but I don't think it is.
No, because they call them Imperial Walkers. They know what they're dealing with.
So though it's the first we've seen them.
Nobody is saying, what the fuck is that?
I mean, the one guy goes, it looks like, I guess he's saying it looks like the Walkers, right?
Yeah. I mean, they got to like zoom in and confirm. They got to make sure they know what they're looking at. But
and the
Empire's always like displaying new war technology. So you never know.
The Walkers are just so cool and were and just captured, I think, everyone's imaginations as a kid or whatever, seeing this for the first time, right?
Well, they're very evocative of the old, like, Roman war elephant stuff of just, like, at a certain point in the distant past, you would have these warrior cultures that would be doing their thing in the Mediterranean, and then if somebody rolls up with a fucking elephant, you're going to lose your mind because you have no idea what you're looking at.
Right, and it perfectly works for the sort of imperial stomping, right, of it, where it's just like, it's this thing that's not fast by any means, but it's just this unstoppable thing slowly moving towards you. Because they really are more intimidating than they... I mean, of course, they can destroy, but it really is, the scale of them is just awe-inspiring as much as it is a tactical thing.
Right. And, like, you really have to do some mental gymnastics to figure out why this would be a practical tool in the imperial military system.
Yeah, because it does seem like they're not going to cover ground very fast. It's like, we'll be there in 2 days with the walkers.
No, but the idea is that, A, it's a troop transport is more what it is, because that's what the AT-AT stands for, all-terrain assault transport.
Right.
And so, like, those big boxy bits on the back is to just hold a crap load of dudes.
Right. And that makes sense. Like we're saying. And so, and like I said, yeah, and they are just like, Jesus, they're overwhelming. The AT-STs are a little bit more mobile and attack oriented.
Yeah, exactly. These things are meant to, like, stomp in, destroy a crap load of stuff on the way in, and then, like, squat down and start pooping out stormtroopers.
That thing's crapping stormtroopers! all right. And then, boy, this next full page of just the thing firing from below.
Yeah.
Are there more accentuated necks in the comic book version of these things? I don't remember these necks being quite this... I mean, they have necks and they move around, but they seem like really long necks.
These are maybe a little bit more heightened, a little bit more flexible in the comic than we see in the movies. I love this page so much.
It's an awesome individual drawing. And once again, having somebody like Williamson, who is, unlike Infantino, taking the time to do all the intricacies of the wiring and riveting and individual pieces of it. Like, it, this feels real and tactile in a way we haven't seen in this comic so much.
But you also have the color splash in the back that is echoing the rebellion symbol with the AT-AT at the center of it. Like, it's just, oh, this is art right here.
This is really good. This is a really good individual piece that talks about, like, what can you do in a comic that just, like, this is not equivalent to anything you could do on screen.
Right.
No,
and I just want to linger on this because it's so good.
And then what's great is that they follow it up on the next page with these guys just getting exploded. Bodies are flying. Fire is everywhere. You are getting such a sense of the decimation this thing is doing.
Yeah, suddenly we have a panel from the Nom.
Yeah. I mean, I love the Rebel Ground Forces. No devastation. That's good writing, Goodwin. That's being precise and succinct, which is rare for you.
I think he does pretty good in this book. Obviously, last issue, we had some issues with, like, the telling not showing. But I think this issue really, like, keeps it a lot tighter.
I agree. I think this one is better. He ebbs and flows with that, I think. Yeah. Interesting. And so, okay, now we've got the snow speeders flying out.
Rogue leader to Rogue 3. Of course, Wedge being Rogue 3, we know.
Split
into pairs, and Wedge coming back with, sure, if the Death Star didn't stop you and me, what can these things do? I love Wedge.
Wedge is the best. Wedge is the best. We all know this. And so we get, once again, another great... I didn't even know how to describe it, because obviously it's a drawing, but, like, in the film parlance, Williamson's choices of, like, camera angles are fantastic. His framing on this, right? Like, the way that this snowspeeder is positioned, we're looking down over it at it shooting the AT-AT. Great.
Yeah. Really good. The lasers look a little weird. They look like flashlights coming out of this thing.
But of course, that, yeah, that does look a little strange. Just like, I got my headlights on him.
it's not doing anything.
Yeah. I don't know what it is. I just keep flashing my headlights at him and he's not slowing down. pull over to the side, pal. Do you have a permit for that thing? And so, yeah, so we see that it's like, oh, well, the armor's too strong for our blasters. And then immediately two snow speeders go up when we turn the page.
Yeah, and also Dak dies.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And Dak. And I love the just Dak, and then he's just him just slumped dead.
I feel like that panel. The confirmation of Dak being dead is way more spelled out in this book than it is in the movie. Because in the movie, like, we don't assume Dak is dead, really, until the AT-AT stomps on him.
Yeah, it's more on the ground. It seems like he's could be unconscious, and then you're like, no, he just got stomped.
Yeah.
He's not responding to Luke anymore, and then the stomping is the definitive. Because I think Luke even tries to get him out of the cockpit.
Yeah.
Once they crash, yeah. And then meanwhile, we cut to Han and Chewie are still working that Falcon, and Han's like, it's got to be good enough, Chewie.
Yeah, it's going to have to... First chance we get, we're giving this crate a complete overhaul, but under the circumstances, pal, the weld's tight enough. In fact, I bet it's going to hold a lot longer than this joint's ceiling.
Yeah, and so we do see, when we turn the page, I love the like steam coming off of this guy.
Well, I think it's supposed to be like bits of the ceiling falling down.
But it looks like he's steaming.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. And so he's basically just like, it's not going well out there.
And Leia's like, look, we're going to have to start launching multiple transports at once. It's risky, but we got to get the heck out of here.
Once again, cool-headed, awesome military leader, Leia. I love it.
Yeah. Leia gives the order with finality, hiding all regret and concern as nearby Luke Skywalker's voice crackles on one of the comm links.
See, that's fine. That's not describing something that's in visuals. And this is where Luke figures out, use your harpoons and tow cables to bring down the walkers, which is so cool. It's always the cool David and Goliath imagery of the little snow speeders bringing down the giant walkers, right? That's just very cool.
Well, and that's what this movie really establishes is, and this the story of Empire.
Yeah.
It really establishes the asymmetrical warfare that the Star Wars is, right? Because you have this giant galactic empire with all the technology and all the resources, and the rebels just have to scrape together what they can using the Force and chewing gum.
Well, and that's why the AT-ATs are perfect. And much like the Star Destroyers and, of course, the Death Star itself, it's like everything is just gigantic with the Empire, right? They're always going for overwhelming force. And the rebels always have to come up with these scrappy ways to defeat that.
And like to say that this wasn't a political story that was talking about like American military imperialism is ridiculous, right?
No politics. Yeah. Keep your politics out of my Star Wars.
Right. No, and that's why like George Lucas's comments about Vietnam were so poignant about this sort of thing, because it is like this impossibly invincible, overwhelming material power being bogged down less than actually defeated.
Of course. I don't. Once again, it's like you have to be not even an idiot, but you have to like just be purposefully ignorant. You have to be actively ignoring things and like spinning them in a different direction to not see that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I mean, it's not even subtle how much the prequels are his screed against the post-9/11 Bush administration, particularly the second 100%. Two. I mean, it's almost, if anything, a criticism I have of the movie is maybe need to be a little bit more subtle. So that's,
If there's one thing the prequels are not being threatened by, it is their lack of subtlety.
Here's one of the craziest things to think about. This is crazy, right? And this comes up every once in a while. George Lucas's initial plan was he was going to make Star Wars and then he was going to make Apocalypse Now. He was originally going to direct Apocalypse Now. So... which is, of course, I mean, and then instead he goes and makes more Star Wars movies. But that's how much he was going to make. He was going to follow up Star Wars with an overtly political movie about, literally about the Vietnam War. There's a lot of speculation of what the Lucas version of Apocalypse Now would have looked like. I don't want a Batman. I don't think it would have been as good. I'm just saying. I just think Coppola, what, I mean, it certainly wouldn't have looked like Coppola's movie. There's sure. no question about that. Anyway, so yeah, they're bringing down the walkers, and man, the shot of the cable swinging around the legs, and then the actual destruction of it, and the way it's in like a death throw, this machine.
Yeah, it's really
so
good.
So cool.
Williamson. And,
yeah.
Turns out Al Williamson's a good artist.
Really good. Really, really good. And like I said, in the way that we, and once again, it's not even necessarily a complaint, but the way we point out that Infantino feels maybe a little out of date, Williamson really feels of this era. This feels like totally. What I think of as 80s Marvel art. And who is it who brings down this AT-AT? It's our boy Wedge.
Yeah, of course. Wedge is the...
Wedge is the unsung is hero of Star Wars, man. He is the working man's hero of Star Wars.
We see a lot of this in the Rogue One, like, novels and comics. It's this idea that, like, okay, the story of our main characters, of Luke, Leia, and Han, those are happening.
Yeah.
Everyone else
yeah.
who is functioning as the support system for the Rebellion knows that Wedge is, like, the top gun, right?
Wedge is the Maverick, right? Of the yeah. It's not Luke. It's Wedge.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, no because question.
Luke fucks off to Dagobah for 4 months, yeah. or however long it takes place yeah. in this movie. And meanwhile, like, Rebel's still got a Rebel. We still got to fight the Empire. Who's at the front of that? It's Wedge.
Watch what I'm saying. He's the working class hero. He's the guy out there going out there doing his job every day. Luke's doing the showy stuff, but this is the guy who time after time, battle after battle, is putting the hours in, man. Oh, we are a Wedge-focused podcast. No question, man. Wedge is our guy.
Ugh, yeah,
love him. Okay. Love.
So yeah, he takes down the AT-AT. Then we get a really stark panel yeah. of.
I do like the way
Luke
he uses,
Skywalker here.
He does this thing where he pulls out into the white, where it's the there's nothing, but it doesn't feel like oh, I just don't want to draw a background. It goes to the whiteout of the ice planet. It almost feels like right. It feels like it's calculated empty space as opposed to just going like I didn't want to draw a background.
Well, because it's speaking to the isolation, because yeah. we have this dialogue here where it says, let's try and get this one for Dak. Like, yeah. he knows Dak is dead.
Yeah. I'm smelling him, man, already.
Dak is dead. One of my go-to cheat codes in the Rogue Squadron 2 video game.
There you go. And so, yeah, we're continuing to see the battle. And then Luke, the back of his snowspeeder, of course, gets hit by the walker, and then we get this cool, once again, great Williamson stuff, the way the snow is bouncing and flying around as the snow speeder crashes into it.
He bounces a few times.
I like the description of skidding and plowing under the frozen plain far, far below. It's good stuff.
Yeah, no, good stuff.
And then the way we come out of it, and it's like half buried in snow on the next page.
Yeah, for some reason, Luke's helmet gets really, really big in that second panel, but
or his head gets really, really small. Either way, I don't know. It's strange.
One of those.
And I don't know that we need the still in one piece. All this snow lessen the impact, but got to get out of here. Some 9 times out of 10, the thought balloons are unnecessary in this comic. But then,
yeah.
once again, the cut to the so sinister vibe of inside the AT-AT.
Mm-hmm. We're at 3.2.5, sir, coming within range of the power generator.
Increase speed.
That's Veers right there.
Crush anything that gets in our way.
Mm-hmm.
And oh no, Luke Skywalker is going to die, you guys. I am so worried about him.
I think the framing on this last panel could have been a little better because, like, in the movie, we have the AT-AT, like, about to stomp on this.
Yeah.
I think he could have made this a little bit more threatening.
Because we know how slow those things are, and it seems like Luke is pretty far away to get out of the way right now.
Yeah.
At a walking pace, he could easily escape this thing at this distance. And that's where we leave it, because next issue, Imperial Pursuit.
Yeah, I think the Empire is gonna pursue.
Well, they're striking back. They're going to pursue at the same time. That's a lot. They're multitaskers, those Imperials.
How do you feel about the pacing of this so far as we reach the end of this issue? It's one of the things we talked about in all of the adaptations of A New Hope is how comic books chose to pace the book thus far. So we've spent two issues of the six we know we're going to have here on Hoth, and presumably we won't even get off Hoth until halfway through the next
issue. I will say
issue.
That surprised me that we were not already off Hoth by the end of issue two, because I thought it made sense to go the Han rescuing of Luke as issue one, issue two is the Battle of Hoth. Then I thought issue three would be the aforementioned Imperial Pursuit and Luke going to Dagobah. But it does seem like it's a little... I don't know that... intellectually, it feels slower than I would have expected, but it doesn't feel that slow.
Yeah, I think I'm basically on the same page, because we've definitely had a couple of the adaptations we've read feel like slogs, right?
Yeah.
Especially going back to the original A New Hope adaptation that Marvel did, it felt a little bit like,
well,
okay, we're kind of just, we're still on Tatooine? Okay.
Well, I think some of that is, the first movie is slower in general, right? Like the beginning of New Hope, I feel like every time I watch it, I'm surprised again by like how long it takes to get going. Not that it's boring per se, but you're more like, God, that's right. Han doesn't come into this thing for like 45 minutes. And it takes, you know, probably 15 to 20 to even get to Luke. And you're just like, God, that's right. I feel like every time I watch. So in some ways you're dealing with that. I think too, as much as we bag on Goodwin sometimes for overwriting, he's not even close to as bad as Roy Thomas, who just filled those panels with words. And I think Williamson's art is just more evocative and more exciting too. So it feels like this just feels better made in every sense. So I think that's also helping with the pacing.
There isn't this sense of wasted panels in this adaptation the way we've gotten in some of our other adaptations, where it's like we could spend a whole page being told and shown something that isn't actually, doesn't feel like movement. And while this adaptation does have some of that, it is done for effect. When you have the page of the walkers being seen on the horizon, that is establishing their big menacing nature. When you have the whole splash page of the walkers head firing with the rebel symbol behind, like that's to evoke, and like it is giving you a sense of these things in a way that like some of the other adaptations really haven't.
Well, I think also Star Wars is important now. It's once again, it's no longer that thing we got the rights to, so let's just kind of put this together and it happens to work for them. Here it is like people are going to be buying this one probably more than the other issues because it's the Empire adaptation. So let's put the work in. Let's craft this. You know, let's really make sure this is good. And we already saw they delayed it, which maybe speaks to them going, this needs to cook a little longer. Or I don't know. Who knows? But I mean, like...
Knowing Marvel of the early 80s, I really doubt that was the reason. But,
but it just feels like this feels a little more polished than a lot of the issues we've been reading, right? It just feels like, and some of that is just Williamson's art in general. I think he's just a younger, hungrier artist than
Infantino. And obviously Williamson not necessarily getting all the credit here, because we have to give it up to Glennis Oliver, who's on the colors of this book, who's like, we've been talking about some of the phenomenal mood coloring here, and that's absolutely on Glennis Oliver, who credited in this book as Glenn Wein at the time.
The colors and inking are really effective, and those are two things that I would say this book has struggled with, right?
Yeah.
and that makes sense to me that Williamson is really known as an inker, because that instinct, even if he's not doing all the inking himself, the instinct of where to sort of direct that is really clear here. It's really effective stuff. So I think, on the whole, this is a huge step up from the New Hope adaptation.
Totally. Now, I can't wait to see some of the other, because we will eventually be doing the other Empire Strike Back adaptations. I think we got the manga one lined up.
Yep.
And maybe one other. We'll see.
I can't remember. Was there a special edition Dark Horse one?
I'm trying to track it down. We'll see. Like I said.
All right. If we don't get to that one, I'm not going to be heartbroken based on our experience.
Exactly.
With the New Hope one. but yeah, of course, if you want even more from this show, you can head over to our Podbean patron page, which is patron.podbean.com/punchup. Once again, it's patron.podbean.com/punchup. There you can get cool exclusive bonus content from this show and all the shows on the Punch Up Entertainment Network, as well as helping support us to make better podcasts.
Indeed. You can listen to all of those other shows and watch this one, which we always say is one of the better ways to consume the show. So you can read the book along with us over on our YouTube page, youtube.com/pawnshopentertainment. There you can like, comment, subscribe, ring that bell, all of those little things to help us along the algorithm. All of them really help. Let us know in the comments below, what is your favorite line in Star Wars that always like strikes you? I have the, well, good, our first catch of the day. What are the ones you find saying to yourselves? I know I have you now is a classic that sometimes people say when they're really getting that good parking space at a Walmart or what have you.
Yeah. Specifically, you hear it all the time in a Walmart parking
lot. All the time at Walmart, John. All the time. And look, I'd love not to shop there, but until I can afford it, I can't morally disregard the Walmart. So I apologize.
The prices are so low.
It's just too good. It's just too good.
Yeah, it's I don't go to Walmart really, but that's my Amazon thing. It's just like, yeah, but guys, it's, I know.
I know I'm supporting an evil corporation, but until I can buy this many batteries for that cheap, I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
You know, they'll just bring it to me. anyway, yes, of course, make sure to do that. But yeah, I think that wraps things up for this week's episode.
Yes, indeed, because as always, I have been Mike Gergoni.
I'm John Campbell.
And remember, may the panel be with you.